This morning, I'll be reading from the Gospel of John, chapter 7, beginning in verse 1. After this, Jesus went about in Galilee. He would not go about in Judea, because the Jews were seeking to kill him. Now the Jews' feast of booths was at hand. So his brothers said to him, "Leave here and go to Judea, that your disciples also may see the works you are doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." For not even his brothers believed in him. Verse 14. About the middle of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and began teaching. The Jews therefore marveled, saying, "How is it this man has learning when he's never studied?" So Jesus answered them, "My teaching is not mine, but his who sent me. If anyone's will is to do God's will, he will know whether the teaching is from God or whether I'm speaking on my own authority. The one who speaks on his own authority seeks his own glory. But the one who seeks the glory of him who sent him is true, and in him there is no falsehood. Has not Moses given you the law? Yet none of you keeps the law. Why do you seek to kill me?" The crowd answered, "You have a demon. Who is seeking to kill you?" Jesus answered them, "I did one work, and you all marvel at it. Moses gave you circumcision, not that it's from Moses, but from the fathers, and you circumcise a man on the Sabbath. If on the Sabbath a man receives circumcision so that the law of Moses may not be broken, are you angry with me because on the Sabbath I made a man's whole body well? Do not judge by appearances, but judge with right judgment." Some of the people of Jerusalem therefore said, "Is not this the man whom they seek to kill? And here he is speaking openly, and they say nothing to him. Can it be that the authorities really know that this is the Christ? But we know where this man comes from. And when the Christ appears, no one will know where he comes from." So Jesus proclaimed as he taught in the temple, "You know me, and you know where I come from. But I have not come on my own accord. He who sent me is true, and him you do not know. I know him, for I come from him, and he sent me." For they were seeking to arrest him, but no one laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come. Yet many of the people believed in him. They said, "When the Christ appears, will he do more signs than this man has done?" This is the word of the Lord. You may be seated. I want to begin with a bit of a thought experiment. If you were to write your own version of the gospel story, recording the life and ministry of Jesus, what would you include? For those of us who are familiar with the story of Jesus, we would probably include the miracles he performed, the parables he taught. We would certainly include his death on the cross and his resurrection. We might include stories about his disciples and the people who first came to believe in him. But I wonder, would any of us think to include in great detail an account of everyone who opposed him? Would we think to include the stories of those who did not believe in Jesus? Over the last several months, we've been working our way through the Gospel of John. And one of the themes we've seen in John's Gospel is belief. Later, towards the end of John's Gospel, he tells us that this is why he's written the Gospel of John, so that all who hear the story of Jesus and hear about the signs he performed and the things that he said might believe, and in believing have life in his name. So here's the question. For a gospel that is centered on the theme of belief, why does John spend so much time describing people who didn't? Here in John chapter 7, we're given story after story of people who did not believe in Jesus. Why does John tell us about them? Well, I think it's because he wants us to understand where unbelief comes from. And in understanding the origins of unbelief, that we might know what it truly means to believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God and the Savior of the world. And that we might know what it means to tell that story to the ends of the earth. So the first group of people that don't believe that John introduces us to are Jesus' own family. First, we're going to look at the unbelief of his brothers. Look with me, John chapter 7, beginning in verse 1. John tells us that Jesus went about in Galilee and that he would not go into Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. So John picks up right where we ended last week in chapter 6, where many of the initial followers of Jesus have abandoned him. No longer could they stomach the things that Jesus is saying, and so they've now turned their back on him. And in fact, at this point in the Gospel of John, we've seen the opposition against Jesus building. And we can trace it all the way back to a miracle that Jesus performed, where he healed an invalid at the pool of Bethesda on the Sabbath. From that moment on, many Jews wanted to kill him. They wanted to kill him because they thought that Jesus was breaking the Sabbath by healing a man. They also thought that Jesus was committing the sin of blasphemy by claiming to be the Son of God. So they wanted him dead. And Jesus knew it. And so he had retreated into the countryside with his disciples, and for months he's been teaching his disciples. And now in verse 2, we're told the Feast of Booths was at hand. This is 6 months after the Passover. 6 months after the feeding of the 5,000. Now, next week we'll talk more about the Feast of Booths, but for this week, this is what I want you to know. The Feast of Booths is also known as the Feast of Tabernacles. It was a celebration that happened around harvest time where the Jewish people would get together for an entire week, in fact, 8 days. It would begin on one Sabbath, and it would end on the following Sabbath, the eighth day. And throughout that week, the Jewish people would celebrate the harvest, and they would give thanks to God for all that he had provided for them. But they would also look back on his provision for the people of Israel during their wandering in the wilderness during the Exodus. And that is why it was called the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles. You see, for this entire week, not only each day did they give offerings to God, but they would make these kind of makeshift tents or booths, and they would live in them for the week to remind them of what it was like for the people who had gone before them as they wandered in the wilderness. And during the Feast of Booths, crowds and crowds of people would go to Jerusalem. And so Jesus' brothers are coming to him and they're saying, "We think you should go to Jerusalem, because that's where everyone is going to be." Look with me at verse 3. "So his brothers said to him, 'Leave here and go to Judea, that your disciples also may see the works you are doing.'" Now, I just said something that some of you probably overlooked, and for others of you, it may have come as a great surprise. Did you know that Jesus had brothers? He also had sisters. John's already introduced us to them earlier in John chapter 2. These would have been the naturally born children of Mary and Joseph, the younger siblings of Jesus. And just like any good younger sibling, they've taken it upon themselves to give advice to their older brother. And this is what they tell Jesus to do. They say, "Go to Judea, that your disciples also may see the works you are doing. Show yourself to the world." Jesus' brothers want him to come out of hiding and to go into the crowds, into a very public place in Jerusalem during the feast, in order to prove himself, to show himself to the world. They want him to put on a show. Now, we don't know exactly what motivated them. We do know that they want him to prove himself to the masses, but the question is why? Well, I want you to imagine what it must have been like to have been the brother or sister of Jesus. those of you with siblings of your own, what do you think it was like for them? Can you imagine how annoying that must have been to see Jesus run off to the temple at age 12? To see him throughout his public ministry say the things that he said. What do you think it was like for them? John tells us that Jesus knew that people wanted to kill him. Don't you think his brothers knew that too? Do you think they ever wondered, well, if they want to kill our brother Jesus, what do you think they're going to do to us? As people began to abandon Jesus and turn their back on him, do you think they ever felt ashamed of Jesus? Ashamed to call him family? See, the Gospel of Mark tells us at one point, the brothers and sisters of Jesus tried to seize him because they thought he was crazy. We don't know exactly what motivated the brothers of Jesus to tell him to go into the crowds and to show himself to the world. But what we do know is they didn't tell him to show himself because they believed in him. No, they told Jesus to show himself to the world because they didn't believe in him. I want you to look with me at verse 5. For not even his brothers believed in him. Not only did Jesus have brothers, but his own brothers didn't believe in him. I think this is incredible. Jesus' own family rejected him. They opposed him. They didn't believe in him. Why? Well, I think the answer is pride. I think the Gospel of Matthew helps us understand where this pride comes from. This is Matthew 13. I want you to listen. As Matthew describes Jesus going back to his hometown. He tells us, Matthew 13, 53, that when Jesus had finished teaching in parables, he went away, and he went to his hometown, and he taught them in their synagogue, so they were astonished. And they said, "Where did this man get this wisdom and these mighty works? Is not this the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary? And are not his brothers James and Joseph and Simon and Judas, and not all of his sisters with us? When did this man get all of these things?" And they took offense at him. But Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and in his own household." And he did not do many mighty works there because of their unbelief. Jesus is teaching in the synagogue to a bunch of people that he grew up with. And they begin to ask questions of him, saying, "Wait a minute, we know your family. We know where you grew up. We were right there with you." In other words, they're saying, "Who does Jesus think that he is? We know this kid. We know his family. How can he say that he is the Son of God?" Now imagine what it must have been like for his own family members. And so Jesus says, "A prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and in his own household." Why? Because of pride. See, there's a saying that's often associated with this verse. A saying that goes like this: familiarity breeds contempt. You can trace it all the way back to Augustine in the 5th century. What it means is that the longer you're around someone, the more annoying they become to you, or the more that you begin to take them for granted. And though none of us grew up in Jesus's family, we have all grown up, if we've grown up here in Dallas, in a culture where Jesus has become very familiar. We could say the same thing of many of us. Familiarity breeds contempt. Because when we think on our own terms that we are familiar with someone, it actually gives us pride to think that we know better than them. Pride to take them for granted. Pride that must have occurred in the hearts of Jesus' own brothers that felt ashamed to be associated with him. And so out of pride, they told Jesus to go to the feast. Go to the feast and put on a spectacle. Reveal yourself to the world and clear the family name. What they could have never imagined is that Jesus would one day go to Jerusalem. But instead of putting on a spectacle and a show, he would put on the greatest display the world has ever seen, the spectacle of the cross, where he was crucified outside the camp, conquered death and sin, and rose again. So first we see the unbelief of his brothers, but then John introduces us to the unbelief of the crowds. Look with me, verse 14. John tells us about the middle of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and began teaching. And as he goes up to the temple, he's doing what his brothers told him and going to the feast, but he's not going to put on a show. No, instead he's going to teach. And as he begins to teach, the people begin to whisper about him. They begin to gossip about him, murmuring false assumptions about him. John describes it this way in verse 12. It's not in your bulletin, just listen. John tells us there was much muttering about him among the people. Some said, he's a good man. Others said, no, he's leading people astray. Can you imagine what it must have been like? Here's Jesus, all of a sudden, coming out of nowhere, teaching in the temple, no less. And all of a sudden, there begins to be this roar of whispers. People turning to their neighbor left and right. He's a good man. No, he's leading people astray. He cannot be trusted. Oh, I heard that he healed a man on the Sabbath. Oh, I heard that he turned water to wine. Oh, I heard he didn't actually do any of those things. Muttering, whispering, gossiping, telling one another all of these assumptions about who they think Jesus is, trying to make sense of him. And so Jesus reveals who he is, not with signs and wonders, but with teaching in the temple. Verse 15, we're told that the Jews who were there were marveled, but not in a good way, and they say, how is it that this man has learning when he's never studied? You see, in those days, if you were going to teach in the temple as a rabbi, you had to have training. You had to have a rabbi who taught you. And then there was a rabbi who taught that rabbi, and a rabbi who taught that rabbi, and a rabbi who taught that rabbi. They expected that anyone who would come to teach in the temple with authority would have some kind of rabbinic pedigree, some kind of resume, some kind of training. And so they're asking Jesus, well, who's your rabbi? What authority do you have to come and teach like that in our temple? You see, I think they'd forgotten a passage in the Old Testament that they had probably memorized. A passage by the prophet Isaiah who describes what the Messiah, the Christ, will one day be like. Isaiah 53, he says that he had no form or majesty that we should look at him, no beauty that we should desire him. You see, I think it's easy for us to forget as well. It's easy for us to have our own assumptions about who we think Jesus is. Because after 2,000 years of icons and images about him, and Renaissance paintings, and even Jesus action figures, all of us have an idea of Jesus that cannot compare to the real thing. So let me ask you, Where have you gotten your understanding of who Jesus is? Have you gotten to know Jesus through his word, the stories of the gospels, spending time with him, the things that he said and did? Have you gotten to know Jesus through the story of redemption from Genesis to Revelation? Or has your understanding of Jesus been warped by popular assumption? See, just as pride leads to unbelief, so does assumption. And when we make assumptions about Jesus, we fail to see him for who he really is. And you cannot believe in Jesus unless you see him rightly. And so Jesus answers these people. Verse 16, he says, "My teaching is not mine, but his who sent me. If anyone's will is to do God's will, he will know whether this teaching is from God or whether I'm speaking on my own authority." In other words, Jesus is saying, I don't have a rabbi because God is my rabbi. And I have not been taught the truth. Jesus is saying, I am the truth. And I have come with the very authority of the one who sent me as the Son of God. He is coming to bring this truth to bear. And as he brings this truth to bear, he confronts the people around him. Verse 19, he says, "Has not Moses given you the law? Yet none of you keeps the law. Why do you seek to kill me?" He's saying, you know the law, but in your striving to try to follow the law, none of you actually fulfill it. You see, because in those days, the people had divorced the law from the person of God. And they made the law about themselves rather than the law about God. And they failed to see that Jesus was sent by God to fulfill the law for you and for me. And now they want to kill him. As Jesus says this to them, they answer right back to him. They say, "You must have a demon." Won't be the last time in the Gospel of John where he's accused of having a demon. You see, if Jesus isn't actually the Son of God, it's the only explanation they can come up with. How can he say these things and do these things? He must be possessed by a demon. That might sound strange to our modern ears in a disenchanted world. But we, in our own skepticism, might often say the same thing. Oh, Jesus must have been crazy. He didn't know what he was talking about. And so then Jesus confronts them once more. And as he confronts them, he goes back to the source, the reason why they want to kill him. Verse 21, he says, "I did one work, and you marvel at it. Moses gave you circumcision, and you circumcise a man on the Sabbath. If on the Sabbath a man receives circumcision so that the law of Moses may not be broken, are you angry with me because on the Sabbath I made a man's whole body well?" What is Jesus talking about? Well, he's bringing up the very reason that they are so angry with him. The very reason they want to put him to death. You see, they thought Jesus broke the Sabbath by healing a man on the Sabbath. Do you hear how ludicrous that is? Jesus healed a man, and they're not paying attention to that. They're paying attention that he did it on the Sabbath. And this is Jesus' point. He's saying, you circumcise a man on the Sabbath, and yet you don't call that work. Because you believe it makes a man whole. What's the difference between that and actually making a man whole by healing him and saying, "Get up and walk"? You see, their vision of the scriptures was just superficial. Their understanding of the law was so shallow. And so Jesus says, "Do not judge by appearances, but judge with right judgment." They could not see Jesus and his power as the Son of God through their own assumptions about the scriptures and who they thought the Christ should be. it is easy for us to have the same kind of pride that his brothers had, a pride that leads to denying that Jesus is who he says he is. And in a culture like ours, it's easy to be so filled with assumptions about Jesus that we don't see him for who he says that he has come to be. You cannot believe in what you do not see. And we cannot see Jesus apart from the cross and apart from his resurrection. That's where I want to end. Last, John introduces us to the unbelief of the authorities, the Jewish authorities who want to put him to death. Verse 25, we're told that some of the people who were there in Jerusalem at the feast therefore said, "Is not this man whom they seek to kill?" And here he is speaking openly, and they say nothing to him. Can it be that the authorities really know that this is the Christ? You see, these people know that Jesus stands accused. They know that people want him to be put to death because he's broken the Sabbath and committed blasphemy. And so they're asking, why hasn't anyone done anything about it? Why haven't the authorities already arrested him? Why are they letting him go on like this, teaching in the temple? Why don't they send people right now to arrest him and put him to death? And then they ask the most ironic question. Could it be that the Jewish authorities actually believe that this is the Christ? Maybe that's the only explanation. But of course, that's not the reason. No, the reason is because the Jewish authorities don't believe in him. And they don't believe in him not because of the Sabbath and not because of blasphemy. No, they don't believe in him because of control. See, ultimately, I think the chief aim of the Jewish authorities had nothing to do with the glory of God. It had to do with their own glory. They were in it for themselves, and they wanted control. John tells us that in later, verse 32, again, it's not in your bulletin, just listen, that when the Pharisees heard the crowd muttering these things about him, then the chief priests and Pharisees sent officers to arrest him. Why did they seek to arrest Jesus? Well, it wasn't because they were trying to uphold the glory of God and arresting a blasphemer. No, it's because they wanted control. It was only in hearing the muttering of the crowds that they decided to actually do anything about it, because they wanted to regain their power, to hold on to it at all costs, even to the point of sending an innocent man to the cross. Again, we have to ask, are you and I any different? How much of our lives is spent grasping at control? And this morning, if you think that that is not something that you struggle with, let me ask you, what are you afraid of? What right now in your life is giving you anxiety? You see, our anxieties point to the things that we want to control the most, the things that we want to grip so tightly to and hold on to. And so if you are a recovering control freak like me, let me give you some good news. You aren't in control. And that's good news, because we serve a God who is. A good and gracious God who is in control of all things. And he is working all things together for our good. A faithful Savior who is in control even in the midst of opposition and unbelief. We see in verse 30 that they come to seek to arrest him, but no one laid a hand on Jesus because his hour had not yet come. Jesus said the same thing earlier to his brothers in John 7, verse 6. He said, "My time has not yet come." He said the same thing to his own mother at the wedding at Cana. "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." In the Gospel of John, every time Jesus talks about his time or his hour, he's talking about the hour of his death on the cross. And so the reason why they couldn't arrest him in this moment is because Jesus didn't want them to. Jesus was always in control from the very beginning, and he is in control to the very end. You see, in the midst of unbelief, Jesus went to the cross. In fact, it was through the unbelief of the Jewish authorities that he laid his life down. Through the unbelief of the crowds that yelled out, "Give us Barabbas, crucify him." Jesus died for you and for me. He would put it this way in John 10, where Jesus says, "For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life that I may take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down on my own accord. I have the authority to lay it down, and I have the authority to take it up again." Jesus is in complete control, even in the midst of unbelief and opposition. Let this be an encouragement to us, because as we, as his people, face opposition in a world of unbelief, his work is not finished, and he is working all things together for the good of those who love him. But this is not just encouraging for a place in the world. It's encouraging for a bunch of fellow doubters. You see, throughout our study of the Gospel of John, I've talked about the difference between doubt and unbelief. As followers of Jesus, believers that he is the Christ, our days are often filled with doubt, if we're honest. See, doubt is different than unbelief. Doubt is saying, "I believe, but help my unbelief." Doubt is what we see David in the Psalms when he cries out, "How long, O Lord, will you forget me? How long will you hide your face from me?" John Calvin himself said that when we think of the Christian life, we should not imagine it as unacquainted with doubt. But you see, the difference between doubt and unbelief is pride, just like Jesus' brothers. And when in our pride we deny that Jesus is who he says he is and we reject him, then it becomes unbelief. And what we see is that Jesus, in the midst of unbelief, not only went to the cross, but in the midst of unbelief, Jesus built his church. The greatest example that we have in this passage in the Gospel of John is Jesus' own brothers. In the book of Acts, Luke tells us that after Jesus died and rose again, his disciples were gathered in the upper room along with his brothers and sisters. Wait a minute, what happened? How did his brothers, who once did not believe, why are they now worshiping and praising God after Jesus died and rose again? We're told by the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians that when Jesus rose, he appeared to his brother James. Can you imagine what that must have been like? Imagine what that must have been like for James. Jesus came to his own brother who rejected him, his own brother who opposed him, and he revealed his resurrected body. And he gave him the gift of faith. The very same James who would go on to write the book of James in the New Testament. He is faithful. He is faithful to seek and save the lost. And while you and I may never be commissioned to be home church missionaries, we are all called to the Great Commission, and He is going before us, and His work is not finished. It's not finished in us as we struggle through this life through doubt. And it's not finished in this world as He seeks and saves the lost until He comes again. Let's pray. Father in heaven, would you now help us to see our place in that mission? And oh Lord, may we be encouraged that you, Jesus, are always in control, and that out of your faithfulness, you are faithful even when we are faithless. So, oh Lord, would you meet us in our doubts and our questions? And would you reveal yourself to us just as you've revealed yourself to your brother James? Give us the eyes of faith. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Let's stand and let's sing together.